from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Mass protests, violent clashes, and political chaos prevailed in Egypt this past weekend following the military's removal of President Mohamed Morsi. And as Islamists region-wide decry the ouster and demonstrators on both sides gather violent momentum, we want to discuss what's next for Egypt and really how the United States and other world leaders may respond. And just to update you, Muslim Brotherhood demonstrators claim they were shot by the Egyptian army while protesting peacefully in front of the Republican Guard headquarters. And the army claims armed terrorists were trying to break into the Republican Guard headquarters. The death toll now stands at 51 and hundreds injured. And Islamist groups are calling the killings a massacre. And the Muslim Brotherhood is calling for an uprising. We want to continue following up what's going on in Egypt and also do some analysis here. And joining us is Barzu Daragahi. He's a Middle East and North African correspondent with the Financial Times and former Beirut bureau chief for the LA Times. And we welcome you back to Forum. He's in Cairo, Egypt. Good morning.
It's a pleasure.
Glad to have you. And also glad to have Nizar El-Sayed, who is professor of planning and urban history and chairs the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. Good morning. Good to have you back, Professor El-Sayed. We also want to welcome Lina Khatib, who is program manager for the Program on Arab Reform and Democracy at Stanford. She joins us from Paris this morning. Lina Khatib, good to have you on Forum.
Hello. Hi.
Hi. Glad to have you all. And let me go first to Cairo and Barzu Daragahi. You know, there's been a lot of talk, Barzu Daragahi, about really the possibility of a civil war and something happening in Egypt comparable to Syria. Are we really at that kind of danger point here?
No, not yet. But things are not good. And things took a step in that direction today with what happened this morning. The shooting, really a massacre of people at a sit-in near both a mosque and a military site. The 51, they're saying, killed in this incident. Outpouring of anger on the part of the Islamists. They saw their president, who they believe was unjustly removed from office. They see him humiliated and imprisoned, and they watch as their own ranks are gunned down in their eyes. And this escalation of the polarization between the two camps in the society, I wouldn't say Syria. I think a better model for what could happen here and a dangerous sort of direction that the country is moving toward is Algeria. Listeners may recall the 1992 civil war there that lasted for 8 years. It was also it started similarly. There was an election. The military negated the election after the Islamists won. Islamists went out into the streets in protest. They were killed. They were jailed. They were tortured, and that ignited a 8-year civil war that the country still has not recovered from. And so this is the danger, this is the worry. I've talked to Western diplomats, talked to responsible, independent people here, and this is what they're very, very afraid of at this point.
What about leadership now? Because the hardline Salafist Nasser Party, which supported Morsi's removal, withdrew from talks to choose an interim PR. There was talk that Aldi Mansour, caretaker president and head of the Supreme Constitutional Court, was going to be in charge, and then there was talk about Mohamed Bardet. And the fact of the matter is, there's also a good deal of indictment of former Mubarak military heads being responsible for what's being called a coup here.
Yeah, I mean, what's happened is that whole political process, that transition process, for now at least, has been kind of waylaid by what happened today. The Islamists who were part of the interim coalition have withdrawn their support for the process for now. They could come back in, which is a style of political parties in this part of the world. They could sort of be coaxed back into the process. There has been, you use the word leadership, and it's an interesting word because there has really been none. This interim president, Adli Mansour, former head of the Supreme Constitutional Court, is MIA today. We haven't seen him at all. Instead, we've seen two military men, a spokesman for the armed forces and a spokesman for the Ministry of Interior, get on TV and sort of present their side of what happened at this massacre. And we've also seen the top Islamic scholar in the country, Sheikh Tayyib of the Azhar Institution, coming on TV, again warning of civil war and urging people to step back from the precipice. But, you know, in general, no one has taken a leadership role. No one has said the right thing at this point, and that is very worrying as well.
And Lena Khatib, if I could bring you into this conversation, do you see this likely replicating the paradigm of Algeria, or do you see this perhaps more on the precipice of the kind of chaos we're seeing in Syria?
No, I tend to agree that this is more similar to Algeria than it is to Syria. One big complication in Syria is that it's a very complex society where you have one sect ruling the others. In Egypt, at least, the society is not as divided on sectarian lines, which, you know, has fueled the conflict as we see it in Syria today, along with a number of other factors. But having said that, I think Egypt is entering a period that to me looks quite cyclical, in the sense that we had under Mubarak the oppression of the Islamists, which meant that they had to go underground, which meant that they became popular amongst the population, partly because they were seen as victims of this oppressive regime. Then we had a period of the Islamists ruling, and now it seems to me that the army in Egypt and the leadership currently existing in Egypt under Adli Mansour is doing exactly the same kinds of mistakes that the Mubarak regime had done with regards to the Islamists, which means that in the foreseeable future, it's highly likely that we will see Islamist groups become more extremist, go underground, which is similar to the Algerian case, and eventually probably resurface in the future and perhaps rule again, followed by yet another cycle of unrest.
Well, this cyclicity could mean, in fact, having a leader and then removing the leader and going from one end of the political continuum to the other. But I'm wondering also how you see forces that are behind what's taking place now. For example, in one analysis I read, there was talk about, we mentioned Syria, the concern of young Egyptians being sent to Syria to join in the fight against Assad. And there's also been some concern mentioned about dragging Egypt into a war with Hamas against Israel, and also the role of the Saudis, which may be preeminent.
Did you say a war with the Saudis? You mean between Egypt and the Saudis?
No, no, I said a war with Hamas against Israel, that Egypt would be dragged into the possibility of a war against Israel with Hamas. There's been concern expressed about that under Morsi. Am I being heard by you, Lena Khatib?
Yes. Now I can hear you. Okay, I think it's highly unlikely that Egypt will enter any kind of confrontation with Israel. Right now, the concerns of Egyptians remain mainly very internal. We may see skirmishes at the border. In fact, the crossing to Gaza was closed immediately after the change that we have witnessed in Egypt over the last week. And obviously, Hamas is very concerned. I don't think right now the prospect of war is realistic. However, we are seeing a very polarized society becoming even more polarized, and this is not good for the future stability of Egypt, especially that we don't see any political group being able to bring the rest together and start a process of negotiation and talks. If this does not happen soon, then I think it's very likely that the country would descend into chaos. And Egypt is a huge country, and if chaos ensues in Egypt, I think it would be very, very difficult to control.
Lena Khatib, again, is program manager for the program on Arab Reform and Democracy at Stanford. She's with us from Paris, and we thank you so much for joining us. I want to also go to Nizar al-Sayed, who's with us this half-hour segment, professor of planning and urban history, and he chairs the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at University of California, Berkeley. You know, let's talk with you, Professor al-Sayed, about the role of the United States. I'd like to get your take about how much the Saudis are playing a role in this as well. The Muslim Brotherhood is saying this is a democratic election. It was the first democratic election of a civilian nature in Egypt, and therefore it's legitimate. And this is a coup, and therefore the United States should not continue to give the money that it has been giving, because those are the terms, to Egypt.
Yes, Michael, it's a pleasure to be with you on the show again. Let me start by actually saying that I think there is certainly a need at this very specific moment, not only in Egyptian history, but rather in American-Egyptian relations, for a tempered understanding of what's going on in Egypt today. I don't believe that the situation or the comparison to Algeria or to Syria are in any way actually justified. And I say that because I think not only, as Lena just said, Syria has a particular formula of denominational and of ethnic and of sectarian divides that does not exist in Egypt, but also because of the fact that in the case of Algeria, one has to remember that, in fact, the army intervened to prevent the Islamists from taking power altogether. In Egypt, that did not happen. In fact, the army handed power to the Islamists, and the Islamists ruled single-handedly without any inclusion of any of the other parties in Egypt for an entire year, creating not only chaos but a complete failure in all government institutions. So I think, you know, a tempered analysis would actually allow us to see this as an internal conflict that is going on in Egypt today, not only between the Muslim Brotherhood and their opponents, if you will, those who wanted to remove Morsi, but rather between people who see different visions of the Egyptian state. Some who absolutely wanted an Islamic constitution, which they partly got in December, the constitution that Morsi threw his now deposed and, in fact, dissolved upper house of parliament passed, despite all objections from the courts. And those who believe that Egypt is a civil society and a civil country and a country in which religion plays an extremely important role, but they do not want a religious state or a theocracy altogether. For me, this is the way I see it right now. So to go to your question, which I think is a very important question, the United States had it wrong back in January of 2011, and unfortunately the United States again had it wrong in June 30th of 2013. And by this, I mean the following. I mean, the United States does not really call the shots. Egyptians are always under the impression that the United States does so, but the United States does not fully control the game on the ground. They wanted to support legitimacy, absolutely. They were not necessarily very happy with the election of the Muslim Brotherhood, but they had to make peace with that, and they did by recognizing Morsi, who, one should remember, was only elected with 51% of the vote, and where his opponent was such a hated figure by most of those who demonstrated in the January 25th uprising against Hosni Mubarak. So in a sense, the United States had to accept Morsi. But I think it's a huge mistake to continue to insist on this term sharia, which Morsi has been using, which means legitimacy. Because how would one consider a president who has violated every single court order, who has done everything possible to change the structure of the courts, of course citing that they are from the previous regime, who every time the courts did something that he did not like, he changed the minimum age or the maximum age of judges, changed the number of people who actually sat on the court itself. And if you recall, in December, he decided that he will no longer abide by any court orders because he's above the courts until he cleans the courts. So in a sense, Morsi has lost all forms of legitimacy, particularly during his last week in power.
On that note, I want to actually afford the opportunity of listeners to join this conversation, because I know many of you have strong opinions, but also questions or comments that you might want to bring into the conversation. And let me tell you how you can do that. Our toll-free number is available right now. It's 866-733-6786. And again, we welcome your phone calls. Toll-free, you can join us in this conversation about the mass demonstrations in Egypt, which are gaining momentum, and the shifts in the sands, literally and figuratively, in terms of Egyptian governance and really, unfortunately, the chaos and bloodshed as well. Our toll-free number, again, is 866-733-6786. You can also email us, our email address, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQEDForum, and you can also, of course, go to our Facebook page and go to your calls and emails here forthwith. I want to just go back for a moment, though, to Borzu Darwagahi, who, again, is Mideast and North African correspondent with the Financial Times and former Beirut chief for the Los Angeles Times. And I'm just interested at this point in finding out, just briefly, if I could, from you, Borzu Darwagahi, about the fact that the Egyptian central bank governor has gone off to solicit funds from essentially the major banks in the Gulf, and what's they've already provided a great deal of money. But what's fascinating about this is just the importance of economics in this. I mean, we heard from Nasser al-Sayed about many of the reasons why Egyptians feel that the government under Morsi was illegitimate. But a lot of the anger against Morsi had to do with his failure economically, too, did it not?
Yeah, but I also have to say that many of the things that the professor described were, I almost laughed because it sounded like a lot of the complaints that liberals and the left in the U.S. had about the Bush administration during the 8 years, sort of putting himself above the law and so on. Indeed, the backdrop of this whole political crisis, this Game of Thrones, so to speak, is the economy. The country's economy is in a really bad situation right now. There's warnings that are coming from investment advisories saying that Egypt is on the verge, perhaps, of defaulting on $5 billion worth of debt. There are worries about the country's foreign currency and gold reserves that have dropped last month from $16 billion to just under $15 billion. This is a very, very, very low level that barely is below 3 months of imports, which economists consider a sort of critical threshold for maintaining the solvency of the currency. The currency has fallen. And what this political instability does and today's event does, it pretty much guarantees even more instability, even more uncertainty. I mean, what tourist is going to want to come and see the pyramids at this point, given the scenes that are coming out of Cairo these days? So this is and Egypt is very much dependent on tourism for its hard currency reserves. So this is a very tough situation right now. The stock market today, after picking up a bit in the week after Morsi's overthrow and the popular uprising, is back down again, down 3.5%, I think, today.
And if I could go back to you just for a moment, Nasser al-Sayed, before I bring our listeners in, just wondering how you respond to an email from a listener named Christina, who writes, "While many in the West would have preferred a secular party to win, the Muslim Brotherhood under Mr. Morsi was democratically elected with 52% of the vote, more than our presidents in the past few elections. It was no surprise that the party embraced the notion that politics are subsidiary to religion and what that may carry in its dragnet, diminished women's rights, suppression of economic freedom, judicial systems. What was not voted for was Morsi's desire to change the Constitution to expand his powers with impunity, further economic downturn, and human rights oppression." I think that's pretty much on point with what you're saying, isn't it, Professor al-Sayed?
Christina's absolutely right on the point. And not only that, I think one has to even carry the point further and say it is not just simply about legitimacy or illegitimacy of Morsi. At the moment, it is about the fact that Egypt is a very divided country. This notion that, elections, and I think, President Obama was, again, very much right on target when in his last conversation with Morsi as president, he reminded him that, democracy is not only about elections. It's about a lot more than elections. And I think that the Muslim Brotherhood never really fully understood that, partly because of their history of being oppressed for 80 years, that they thought once they get to power, they should be able to perform exactly like the National Democratic Party or any other majority party that comes into power. The problem is they never really had a mandate, and they never had a mandate not only because of the nature of the election, but because of everything that went wrong under the army in the 18 months in which the Egyptian army set in place this transition to a Muslim Brotherhood rule. So this was very unfortunate, and you see that you mentioned that earlier today. The reason that we cannot have in Egypt a stable government is because one party, which is the Salafi ultra-Orthodox party, which in fact is not friends with the Muslim Brotherhood and participated in approving, if you will, the military takeover, now refuses to have any liberal head the government. And I think they insist on a technocrat, but even the technocrats that were proposed were still not acceptable to them, and they were not acceptable to them mainly from the perspective that this is the party that actually wanted to control women's rights. This is the party that insisted on Sharia as part of this constitution. And in fact, the Muslim Brotherhood folks were the ones who were actually moderate and joined the liberals in the writing of the constitution that passed in December of 2012.
All right, let me bring our callers in, and we begin with Ide from Berkeley. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. I just like to set some sort of straight. Egypt will never be Syria. Egypt will never be Algeria.
Yes.
Egyptians tend to be peaceful by nature, so you're going to have some turmoil for a while. But I tell you, the nightmare is over. Lots of people hated Morsi, not only because of the economics, which is true, but also the way he had this Sharia law and all this garbage. Egypt was always a secular country. Egypt will never be Islamic Republic of Egypt. And he overestimated, actually, governing Egyptian. The last thing I like to say that we have to give the Egyptians the time to settle their differences and not to come with these crazy theories about this or that. And we have to really do the best we can to help Egyptians. But imagine, 33 million Egyptians went out in the street. If that happened in America, you will have 122 million Americans in the street. These people voted with their feet. So, the fact that he was elected only by 11% of the population, by the way. Only 11%. 26% of people voted, and he only got 51% even of that.
Right, I'm looking, actually, at a listener who writes, just dovetailing, says, the nightmare of Morsi and his brotherhood is over. Over 33 million Egyptians marched into the streets of Egypt to expel Morsi and his brotherhood out of office. People voted with their feet, and the army acted the only way it could, by removing Morsi to fulfill the demand of overwhelming majority of Egyptian people. Egyptians have always been secular. The Egyptian flag, till the 1950s, was made of green background and a crescent and three stars. One represented Judaism, one represented Christianity, and one Islam, since Egypt was the birth of monotheism and contributed a lot to the three religions. And I hear your voice, Borsu Dargahi.
Can I just say, I've been in the Middle East for 11 years, and I heard this everywhere. You know, Iraq is not Lebanon. Iraqis are peaceful people. What happened in Lebanon will never happen in Iraq. Syria is a peaceful country. Syrians are civilized. They will never kill each other. Every single country, Libyans are passive people. They will never rise up against Gaddafi. Every single country that I've worked in 11 years, I've heard this from the people there. So I have like a lot of skepticism about the possibilities. I look more at, for example, arms flows. Right now, Egypt is a major weapons transfer point for arms from Lebanon getting to the Gaza Strip and to the Horn of Africa. It won't take a lot for those weapons to not just be transferred through Egypt, but to remain here. And as a matter of fact, there's ample evidence that there are some groups stocking up on weapons. So I love this country. I love Egypt. I live here. I would be very sad if that happened, but I would not listen to the sentimental kind of slogans of people who grew up here and have a certain image of the country. I look at the region and the possibilities and the things that have happened here in the past few years, and I would not discount the possibility of some kind of armed conflict happening here.
Again, Borsu Dargahi is with us from Cairo, and Nazer al-Sayyad.
Michael, I wanted to step in, actually. I happen to fully agree with what Borsu actually just said, and not actually from the perspective of being a realist, but rather because I think that many Egyptians have a very particular and sentimental understanding of their own history. But clearly, this situation, I think one of the things that the Muslim Brotherhood actually did is that they overestimated the kind of support that they had in the Egyptian street. Clearly, there are more opponents to their rule than supporters. Yet, at the same time, I think any reasonable analyst would have to accept that the Muslim Brotherhood, or at least the Islamists, are not only here to stay, that they are likely to play an important role. If that role is not in some way tempered, if it is not, made to formalized and legalized, now that almost Egypt is going in a direction where it's likely to be illegalized, you are likely to see those people go back, if you will, to their caves and engage in, forms of fundamentalism, forms of terrorism that would absolutely destabilize the country. Now, of course, that doesn't necessarily mean that everything that they ask for, as the North Party is asking for today, should be accepted or acknowledged. To the contrary.
Well, the real question is, how can you stabilize this country at this point? But I want to actually bring in another caller, and
yes,
that's William. William, join us.
Yes, thank you very much. I would appreciate any of the guests' perspective on the fact that people seem to say that the military is an honest broker in this, and yet the military controls between 25% and 40% of the entire economy, and the generals benefit from that control financially. So I'm curious as to why it is that since there's severe economic problems, that the people in the streets don't see the military as being partly responsible for these problems.
Well, there was, in fact, Borzo Dargahi, there was initially a lot of sentiment against the military before Morsi came into power. Now it seems to have shifted.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think it's a testament to just how poorly the Muslim Brotherhood performed over the last year, that they actually managed to rehabilitate the image of the military and the make people forget how disastrous their period of rule was. That's how bad the Muslim Brotherhood performed, and it's just like a long story of mistakes and really, really dumb decisions on part of their president and their parliament and their lawmakers and their officials. But yeah, absolutely. And I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, in a month or so with the armed forces in charge, people start protesting against this time again, against the armed forces, because that's what they were doing from January 2011 until the armed forces kind of stepped back from the scene in June 2012.
Let me go to a question here for you, Professor El-Sayed. A listener writes, and this again has to do with the military, since the popular revolt, I have been concerned about the makeup of Egypt's military and where the rank and file's loyalties, religious and civilian, lie. Are there Morsi followers in the ranks who will turn on their own military colleagues or funnel serious arms to the religious zealots now deposed?
Well, you know, this is a very good question. The military, like almost every single aspect or every single institution in Egyptian society, has in fact substantial numbers of individuals who are religious. Some would even go further to argue that the military was infiltrated by the Muslim Brotherhood a long time ago, and that even goes to the security apparatus. As you may know, one of the big things that happened during Morsi's time was this story of police officers who wanted to grow their beards, and they thought the law does not allow them in Egypt to grow their beards. But that became a major issue, which went to the courts, and the courts in the end sided with the security establishment. So there is no doubt that there are Islamic sympathizers within the Egyptian military. But I think the point that you were mentioning earlier and one of your callers talked about also is the Egyptian military does control a considerable part of the Egyptian economy. And that is, in fact, a situation that occurred way back, when Egypt was established first as a republic, and it continued so under the neoliberal policies of Hosni Mubarak, to the point that, a lot of the economists actually do accept that maybe 20% or so of the entire Egyptian economy is run by the military. It has its own bakeries, it has its own hotels, it has its own housing projects, so on and so forth.
We're going to have to leave it there, Professor, because we are flat out of time. But thank you, Nazar El-Sayed, and thank you, Borzo Dargahi, and thank you, Lena Khatib, and thank you, our listeners. Another hour ahead, we're going to talk about skepticism in neuroscience with Robert Burton. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.